Well, good morning. Just like to welcome you all again to Central Church of Christ for all of those of you who are watching with us right now, and all of those of you who are tuning in online all over the globe. We just want to welcome you. If you guys have your Bibles with you, you can go ahead and open them up to the book of Genesis. Genesis chapter 37. We'll begin there in just a few moments. Before we get started, let me just introduce myself. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Luke Reynolds, and I work here now. I have been working here for a whole month, and let me just say you guys have been absolutely fantastic. I just want to thank all of you for your kind words of encouragement, your cards, the food. It's just been absolutely fantastic. You guys have made me and Lena feel very welcome, so thank you. A couple facts about me. I am 21 years old. Married to the love of my life, Lena. We actually just celebrated our two-year wedding anniversary 2 weeks ago. I'm currently a senior at Faulkner University. I am getting my degree in biblical studies. Before moving to Montgomery, I called Gulf Shores, Alabama, my home for 13 years. Now for some real fun facts. I lived at the beach for 13 years, and I absolutely hate it. The water, the sand, the things in the water, the things in the sand. Can't stand it. I hate bacon. I usually get a lot more feedback on that one. Not really a fan of meat at all. It just doesn't have any taste to me. It's really strange. I am, however, a huge fan of Marvel and Star Wars, so I'm sure that Slate's happy that he has somebody that he can vent to now. But now that you know a little bit about the stranger behind the podium, let's get started. So today we're going to be taking a break from the series on Jesus that Slate has been going through. Don't want to mess that up. So instead we're going to be shifting gears, and we're going to take a little bit of a detour. Everyone all over the world has been cooped up for far too long. So today, we are going to pack up, load up, move out, buckle your seatbelts, because ladies and gentlemen, we're going on a road trip. Now, depending on your past experiences, you could either really like that idea, or, I mean, I don't see anybody walking out, but I don't know whether or not you guys are turning off the TV at home. I grew up with two younger brothers, so I understand there's a little bit of controversy when it comes to road trips. As a kid, road trips were always so much more fun. I mean, it was crazy. You wake up, your bags are already packed, they're already in the car, so you get in the car, your mom buckles you up, and then you take a short nap. Next thing you know, you're at Mama and Pa's house. But after a few years, you kind of learn that it's not always like that. All of a sudden, you're packing your own bag, you're loading it in the car by yourself, you can't get comfortable enough to sleep, and then you're miserable for 13 hours because your brother's feet are in your face. Fortunately for us, our road trip today will be 100% metaphorical. So, even better, I've got us a really, really classy driver. I think you guys are going to like him. Before anybody goes on a road trip, though, there is one thing that is more important than anything else. Not a toothbrush, it's not underwear, it's not remembering to put gas in the car. The most important thing for any road trip is the food, right? No? Okay. For some reason, I always get hungrier on car trips than I ever get any other point in time, literally ever. It's so strange. So this morning, we are going to be making a sandwich for our sack lunch for our road trip. We're going to be making a BLT. Super simple, super easy, super nasty. Our first ingredient to our spiritual BLT is, number one, to believe in the journey. If there was ever a Bible character, in my opinion, that would be awarded for believing in the journey, for trusting in the process. I would have to say, hands down, 100%, that award would have to go to Joseph. Now, I know that probably most of you have heard his story 100 times, but let me just remind you. In Genesis chapter 37, we are introduced to a man named Joseph. Joseph was the second youngest of 12 brothers, and unfortunately for him, he was his father's favorite child. Joseph wasn't always the brightest of the bunch. He tattled on his older brothers, causing them to hate him, you know, as younger siblings usually do. He was given a fancy new coat filled with all sorts of these exotic colors, which made his brothers hate him even more. And then, just to top it all off, he was given the gift of dreams. And when he told his brothers about these dreams, how one day they would bow down to him like the stars in the sky or the bundles of wheat, well, that just sent him over the edge. So Joseph's brothers, they throw him into a well, and instead of killing him, they decide to sell him to some Egyptian merchants. They take off his coat, they tear it, they cover it in goat's blood, and then they give it to their father and lead him to believe that their brother has been eaten. Joseph arrives in Egypt in chapter 39 and was purchased by a man named Potiphar. We know that Joseph was an extremely fast learner and that he was a very, very hard worker. And so it doesn't take long for him to be able to work his way up that totem pole. Joseph is described as young and handsome, and Potiphar's wife sure seemed to think so too. She tried to seduce him multiple times, didn't work. Each time he refused. The final time he actually left his cloak in her hands as he ran away. Then Potiphar's wife, of course, lies to her husband and has Joseph arrested. But in all of this, it says God was still with Joseph. Genesis 39:21. Part three of Joseph's life story takes place in a prisoner cell. In Genesis chapter 40, Joseph, being the likable guy that he is, finds favor in the eyes of the jailkeeper, so much so that he's put in charge of all of the other prisoners. The king's baker and his cupbearer are his new roommates, and they've been having some pretty strange dreams. Joseph, in trying to help them, interprets their dreams. One of them he interprets as, "You're going to get out of prison. You're going to get your old job back. Please remember me." And the other as, "You're also going to get out of prison, but you are going to be beheaded, and the birds are going to eat you. I am so sorry." The butler, on the other hand, when he was restored to his service, according to Joseph's prediction, completely forgot about his promise to Joseph, but he did remember when Pharaoh had a series of disturbing dreams a full 2 years later. These dreams would pave the way for Joseph to be brought to the palace. Let's read the interpretation together in Genesis chapter 41, beginning in verse 28. "This will happen as I told you. God is showing the king what he is about to do. You will have 7 years of good crops and plenty to eat in the land of Egypt. But after those 7 years, there will come 7 years of hunger, and all the land that grew in the land of Egypt will be forgotten. The time of hunger will eat up the land. People will forget what it was like to have plenty of food because the hunger that follows will be so great. You had two dreams, which mean the same thing. This shows that God has firmly decided that this will happen, and he will make it happen soon." Now, impressed by Joseph's ability and his knowledge, Pharaoh then appoints him to second in command, sound familiar, right behind him. Thus, Joseph became fully in charge of storing and stocking the food for the upcoming hard times. So when famine eventually did affect his own family back in Canaan, Joseph's father sent his brothers to come and buy food in Egypt. And upon their arrival in chapter 42, they were brought before Joseph, who recognized them immediately. And ironically, they all bowed down to Joseph, just as he dreamed that they would. Joseph conceals his identity to his brothers, locking up Simeon until the rest of the brothers return with Benjamin. Only when Benjamin was brought to Egypt does Joseph then reveal himself. And then, as at the end of the series of tests, Joseph reveals himself to show that his brothers had truly changed. And then at the very end of Joseph's life, he forgives them for all of the evil that they had done to him. Genesis chapter 50, verse 20 says, "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring about this present result, to preserve the lives of many people." And I know that was a really, really long summary. Thank you for bearing with me. But I think that it was necessary to understand that our life isn't just a sprint. Our life is a marathon. And yes, there are going to be a lot of bumps in the road. And it's not just going to be one bump in the road. It's going to be a bump after a bump after a bump. But we have to believe in the journey in order to truly be able to appreciate the destination. If we're going to do something, then we should have hope that it will work out in the end. Otherwise, it isn't even worth doing at all. And for the first time, probably ever, we are facing something that we can't say that we are going through alone. Everyone in the entire world is facing the repercussions of this virus. And although we all cope with things differently, I don't think that anyone can say that they are in this by themselves. But let me tell you this, God would not put us through the fire unless he was going to bring us out stronger. James 1:3 says, "You know that these troubles will test your faith, and this will give you endurance." So we have to believe in the journey itself. Although we don't know why God has allowed this virus to spread throughout the world, we just have to trust that he knows what he's doing. We have to take a step back and let go of the wheel, which leads us to our second ingredient. We have to let God drive. Turn with me now to the book of Jonah, if you will. The story of Jonah is another one that probably most of you guys are familiar with. Those of us who grew up in the church heard this story in Bible class. Maybe you even portrayed some of its characters in a Vacation Bible School skit. If you guys are keeping up with QBS, you know that we actually just went through this 2 weeks ago. But unfortunately, this story has become so common that we just skip right past it, when the fact of the matter is there's actually a lot of things that we can learn from Jonah and from his mistakes. So we're going to try to summarize Jonah's story and then pick out a few key details and attempt to apply them to our life. Jonah's story starts and ends very abruptly. It's like a movie that starts out with this car chase and then ends on a cliffhanger. Verse 1 starts out immediately with God calling Jonah to go to the city of Nineveh and to preach against it. Now, if you're just picking up this book for the first time, never having heard anything about Jonah or the Ninevites, then verse 3 might be pretty confusing to you. Verse 3 says, "But Jonah got up to run away from the Lord by going to Tarshish. He went to the city of Joppa, where he found a ship that was going to the city of Tarshish. Jonah paid for the trip, went aboard, planning to go to Tarshish to run away from the Lord." Now, no matter how familiar or unfamiliar that you may be with this story, I think that all of us can agree that the idea of running away from God isn't a very smart one. In case you didn't know, you can't hide from God. Jonah ends up falling asleep under the deck of the ship, and God sends out this great wind that creates this massive storm. The storm was so bad that the crew, who is used to being in storms, thought that they were going to be torn apart. They start praying and crying out to their gods, but absolutely nothing is happening. So the captain runs downstairs. He shakes Jonah awake, and he begs him to pray to his God in hopes that their lives will be spared. It's only then that Jonah recognizes his mistake, and he admits to the crew that he was running away from God. Let's continue reading in verses 11 through 16. It says, "Since the wind and the waves were becoming much stronger, they said to him, 'What should we do to make the sea calm down for us?' Jonah said to them, 'Pick me up and throw me into the sea, and then it will become calm. I know that this is my fault, that this great storm has come upon you.' Instead, the men tried to row the ship back to the land, but they could not because the sea was becoming more stormy. So the men cried out to the Lord, 'Lord, please don't let us die because of this man's life. Please don't think that we are guilty of killing an innocent person. Lord, you have caused all of this to happen. You wanted it this way.' So they picked up Jonah, and they threw him into the sea, and the sea became calm. Then they began to fear the Lord very much, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord, and they made promises to him. Immediately afterwards, God causes a huge fish to swallow Jonah. Jonah sits wet, cold, and alone in the belly of a fish for 3 days and 3 nights, praying to God and asking him for forgiveness." Now, this is where the story gets really interesting. God tells the fish to spit Jonah out, and then he calls Jonah a second time, telling him to once again go to the city of Nineveh and to preach against them. Notice with me in chapter 3, verses 3 and 4, it says, "So Jonah obeyed the Lord and got up and went to Nineveh. It was a very large city. Just to walk across it, it took a person 3 days. And after Jonah entered the city and walked for 1 day, he preached to the people, saying, 'After 40 days, Nineveh will be destroyed.'" Now, the way that I read this, the whole city is a 3 days walk. It says Jonah entered into the city, and then he walked for 1 day, and then he preached to the Ninevites. So my assumption is that he wanted to be in the very center of the city, where the majority of people would be able to hear this message from the Lord. But the crazy part about this is that the message actually worked. Let's watch the reaction of the people and the king in verses 5 through 10. It says, "The people of Nineveh believed God. They announced that they would fast for a while. They put on rough cloth to show their sadness. And all the people in the city did this, from the most important to the least important. When the king of Nineveh heard the news, he got up from his throne. He took off his robe and he covered himself with rough cloth, and he sat in ashes to show how upset that he was. And then he sent this announcement through all of Nineveh. 'By command of the king and his important men, no person or animal, herd or flock, will be allowed to taste anything. Do not let them eat food or drink water, but every person and every animal should be covered with rough cloth, and people should cry loudly to God. Everyone must turn away from evil things and stop doing harm all the time. Who knows? Maybe God will change his mind, and maybe he will stop being angry, and then we will not die.' And when God saw what the people had done, that they had stopped doing evil, he changed his mind, and he did not do what he had warned. He did not punish them." Now, the craziest part of this story isn't the fact that Jonah was swallowed and regurgitated by a big fish. It's not the fact that the Ninevites all repented and God spared the city. It's not even that everyone on the boat started a fire and offered sacrifices to God in the middle of the ocean. The craziest part to me is in chapter 1, verses 11 through 13. Read it with me again. "Since the wind and the waves of the sea were becoming much stronger, they said to him, 'What should we do to make the sea calm down for us?' Jonah said to them, 'Pick me up and throw me into the sea, and then it will become calm. I know that this is my fault that this great storm has come upon you. Instead, the men tried to row the ship back to the land, but they could not because the sea was becoming more stormy. The crew members are terrified. They're fearing for their lives. They ask for an answer. Jonah gives them their answer, and yet they still try to do it on their own. Not only that, but it gets worse when they do, all because they didn't like the answer that they were given. And this happens to us so many times, far too often, over and over and over again. We put way too much on ourselves, and then when things go wrong and everything goes sideways, it's only then that we look to God and that we ask Him for help. You will never have to carry the full weight of your sin because Christ will be beside you every step of the way, helping you carry it. It wasn't too late for the Ninevites, and it's not too late for us. Think about the story of Jonah as a whole. When God asked Jonah to go to Nineveh, he ran away. And how did that work out for him? He was shipwrecked, or he wasn't shipwrecked. He was caught in a storm, thrown overboard, swallowed by a fish. But then what happened? He still ended up preaching to the Ninevites. We as Christians have got to stop backseat driving. We've got to learn how to just sit back and enjoy the ride. Our lives are far too difficult for us to be able to manage on our own. We need to learn how to be passengers. Our way will never work. Notice what happens when Jonah actually obeys God. The sea becomes calm. All of the Ninevites repented and changed their ways. God's way works, and we just have to trust that. Which leads us to our final ingredient, which is trust that God knows the way. Turn with me now to Daniel chapter 3, if you will. Daniel chapter 3. In Daniel chapter 3, you'll find three of my favorite examples of trust. Three men by the names of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And boy, have they found themselves in quite the pickle. The king, King Nebuchadnezzar, has just built this massive statue. And he makes a public declaration to all of his people to bow down and worship it when they hear the horns blow. King Nebuchadnezzar calls everyone into his courtyard area, and he announces this new rule, and everybody bows down to worship the statue. Almost everyone. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are not bowing down. They're still standing. The horn is blowing, the people are bowing, but three men stand out in the crowd. Now, word travels quickly to the ears of King Nebuchadnezzar, and he demands for these three men to be brought forward. And then he gives them one final chance to bow down and worship the idol. Let's begin reading in verse 14. Nebuchadnezzar said, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, is it true that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden statue that I have set up? In a moment you will hear the sound of the horns, flutes, lyres, zithers, harps, and pipes, and all the other musical instruments. If you bow down and worship the statue that I made, that will be good. But if you do not worship it, you will be immediately thrown into the blazing furnace. What god will be able to save you from my power then?" Listen to their response in verse 16. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered the king, saying, "Nebuchadnezzar, we don't need to defend ourselves to you. If you throw us into the blazing furnace, the God that we serve is able to save us from the furnace. He will save us from your power, O king. But even if God does not save us, we want you, O king, to know this. We will not serve your gods or worship the golden statue that you have set up." This is a crime against the king now. This is punishable by death. Not just any death, may I remind you, but death by a furnace. Is anybody in here afraid of fire? Just another interesting fact about me. I have this irrational fear of ovens. A long time ago at a summer camp, I was doing some work detail, and our group had kitchen duty. And so we're sweeping and we're mopping, and then the kitchen staff asks if any big, strong guys can help and move a potato pan from the oven to the warmer. So, you know, me and my scrawny little 15-year-old, 110-pound self decide this is my big moment to shine. So I stepped up to the plate, but as soon as I lifted that pan, I knew that I had made a terrible, terrible mistake. When I pulled the pan out of the oven, I grabbed the first thing that I saw, which was the back, the very base of the pan. And in case you guys don't know, potatoes aren't light, and this was a big, big pan. And so as this pan begins to tilt, it starts to burn the back of my wrists. But don't worry, I'm a genius. And so me and my genius mind thought of a brilliant plan very quickly, right on the spot. I had just been outside, and it was raining, and I was covered and drenched head to toe in water. And so I thought to myself, you know what? I'll just set this pan down on my leg for a second, readjust, and then we'll be good to go. I found out about 3.5 seconds later that water actually makes it worse. And so I set a 500-degree pan full of potatoes right on my leg, burned straight through my pants, melted through my skin. So I guess technically I should be afraid of potato pans or potatoes, but I just stick with the whole oven situation just to be safe. But these guys are about to go through so much more than just a leg burn, and a lot hotter than 500 degrees too. This guy has a whole furnace that he uses to melt people alive, and it doesn't seem to faze them. When the king heard Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's answer, he's absolutely furious. And so he orders for the furnace to be heated 7 times hotter than normal. Then he orders for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to be thrown inside. This furnace was so hot that the people who threw Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego inside were burned up. What if that's where the story stopped? 3 great men who knew what they believed. They stood up for what was right, tested by fire, literally, and then nothing. You know why that didn't happen? Because God will not put you through the fire and leave you by yourself. He will walk with you every step of the way. And he will pull you out so much stronger than you ever thought that you could be by yourself. Let's pick up in verse 24. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was so surprised that he jumped to his feet. He asked the men who advised him, "Didn't we throw only 3 men into the fire?" They answered, "Yes, O king." The king said, "Look, I see 4 men walking around in the fire. They are not tied up. They are not burned. And the 4th man looks like he is a son of the gods." Then Nebuchadnezzar went to the opening of the blazing furnace and shouted, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, come out. Servants of the Most High God, come here." So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire. And when they came out, the governors, the assistant governors, captains of the soldiers, and royal advisors all crowded around them. And they saw that the fire had not harmed their bodies. Their hair was not burned, their robes were not burned, and they didn't even smell like smoke. Then Nebuchadnezzar said, "Praise the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Their God has sent his angel and has saved his servants from the fire. These 3 men trusted their God. They refused to obey my command. They were willing to die rather than serve or worship any other god other than their own. So now I give this command. Anyone from any nation or any language who has anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego will be torn apart and have his house turned into a pile of stones, because no other God can save his people like this." The most difficult part of a marathon is the last 2 miles. The most difficult part of a journey is the last 3 hours. And I feel like we're kind of all in the exact same place right now. We're all asking the same question. Are we there yet? We have got to stop questioning God's timing. God has a plan for each and every one of us, but for all of us who are feeling discouraged right now, feeling like we're alone, feeling abandoned, God didn't abandon Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace. And he's not going to abandon you in your life right now. We just have to learn to believe in the journey. We've got to stop complaining about the situation that we're in and believe that there is a reason and a purpose that this is happening. James 1:3 again says, "You know that these troubles will test your faith, and this will give you endurance." We have to learn to let God drive. We've got to stop being so set in our ways, trying to tell God what he can and cannot do. Isaiah 55:8 through 9 says, "My thoughts are not like your thoughts. Your ways are not like my ways. Just as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts." And finally, we have to trust that God knows what he's doing. It's been proven time and time again, all throughout Scripture, and I'm sure in your own life as well, that God is actively, actively working. 1 Corinthians 10:13 says, "No temptation has ever overtaken you except what is common to mankind, and God is faithful. He will not let you be tested beyond what you can bear." We just have to learn to trust the GPS, God's positioning system. And let me tell you this, we are almost home. I'd like to read you the lyrics to my absolute favorite song on the radio right now, and then the lesson will be by yours. If you haven't heard this song, this is your homework for tonight. I highly, highly recommend you listening to it. The song is by Mercy Me, and I think that it's perfect to close out our lesson this morning. It goes like this. Are you disappointed? Are you desperate for help? You know what it's like to be tired and only a shell of yourself. Well, you start to believe. You don't have what it takes. Because it's all you can do just to move, much less finish the race. But don't forget what lies ahead. Almost home. Brother, it won't be long. Soon all your burdens will be gone. With all your strength, sister, run wild, run free. Hold up your head and keep pressing on. We are almost home. Well, this road will be hard, but we win in the end. Simply because of Jesus in us. It's not if, but when. So take joy in the journey, even when it feels long. Oh, find strength in each step, knowing that heaven is cheering you on. We're almost home. Brother, it won't be long. Soon all your burdens will be gone. With all your strength, sister, run wild, run free. Hold up your head, keep pressing on. We are almost home. I know that the cross brought heaven to us, but make no mistake, there's still more to come. When our flesh and our bone are no longer between where we are right now and where we're meant to be. When all that's been lost has been made whole again, when these tears and this pain no longer exist, no more walking, we're running as fast as we can. Consider this our second wind. Almost home. Brother, it won't be long. Soon all your burdens will be gone. With all your strength, sister, run wild, run free. Hold up your head. Keep pressing on. We are almost home. Maybe today you're feeling all sorts of emotions. Maybe you feel like you're stuck in traffic. Quarantine has just gotten the best of you. Your depression, your anxiety has settled in. Maybe you just feel jostled, like you've hit a pothole and you've got a flat tire. Or maybe you just feel completely wrecked and abandoned on the side of the road. This morning we're not going to be offering a traditional invitation, but if you have any needs, please do not hesitate to email me, the email that's on the screen above, and I would be happy to make sure that you were taken care of. So hold on just a little bit longer, because the destination is so much better than the journey itself. And if anyone feels what we feel right now, who understands this more than anyone, it would be Paul. So before we close, let me leave you with the words from 2 Timothy chapter 4 to help remind you of what we're striving for. For I'm already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure is at hand. I have fought the good fight, I have finished the race, I have kept the faith. Finally, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give to me on that day. And not to me only, but also to all of those who have loved his appearing. You see that light at the end of the tunnel? We are almost home.